All right. Well, welcome to your City Hall. Today is Tuesday, January 21st, and I'm going to call this January 20th, and I'm going to call the City of Iowa City meeting to order. Roll call, please.
Alter.
Here.
Burgess.
Here.
Harmson.
Here.
Moe.
Here.
Saleh.
Here.
Teague.
Here.
Weiland.
Here.
All right. Well, welcome to your City Hall. For those I haven't seen since last year, Happy New Year. All right. We're going to move on to item number two, which is proclamations. 2A is World Hijab Day. Whereas the people of the great city of Iowa City who come from a variety of backgrounds are united in certain foundational beliefs, including affirming the inherent dignity of all people, the right of every individual to be treated with respect, and the right of all residents to practice their religion freely. And whereas the legislative body is proud to recognize Sunday, February 1st, 2026, as World Hijab Day. And whereas the hijab, a traditional veil which covers a woman's hair, neck, and chest, has been an important part of the history of Islam and is meant to promote dignity, respect for women, while maintaining modesty and honoring religious faith. And whereas World Hijab Day was founded by Naza Khan as a day set aside for women of different cultures who do not normally wear the hijab to experience wearing one for a day, with the purpose of encouraging religious tolerance, cultural understanding, and intentional solidarity. And whereas on February 1st, 2013, the world celebrated the first annual World Hijab Day in recognition of millions of Muslim women who choose to wear the hijab and live a life of religious faith. And whereas since its inception, World Hijab Day has included participants from communities around the globe, and whereas to combat prejudice, leaders within the American Muslim community continue to work diligently to demonstrate that wearing the hijab is a personal choice, a freedom, an expression of faith, while also educating their fellow residents about Islam in meaningful and relevant ways. And whereas one of America's greatest strengths has been its ability to embrace diverse faith and allow individuals to express their beliefs freely. And in this spirit, World Hijab Day encourages understanding, acceptance, and mutual respect among all people. And whereas it is the sense of this legislative body to honor events that highlight the rich and diverse heritage of city, state, and national, while encouraging greater religious tolerance, respect, and understanding within our own community. Now, therefore, I, Bruce Teague, Mayor of Iowa City, do hereby proclaim Sunday, February 1st, 2026, to be World Hijab Day. Yes. And we have a wide variety of people here to accept this proclamation today. And I'm going to ask them all to come up at this time as they give words during this time. And we'll ask the ones that are not speaking to also just stand and let us recognize you, all the folks that are here for this proclamation right now today. If you can all stand and the speakers come forth.
Hello, City Council members and everybody. My name is Umne Ahmed, and I am a senior at West High School. We, as a Muslim community, are so grateful for this proclamation recognizing World Hijab Day. This moment will go down in history as one filled with so much hope. As a Black Sudanese woman who wears the hijab, my lived experience is rooted in my faith as well as my race. These two identities are both frequently misjudged, especially when fused together. Being a Black hijabi, as many of us are here today, we are often criticized first and understood later. But we still wear our hijabs with pride, the item of clothing that shows the world that we are resilient, strong, self-determined women. This proclamation is to every hijabi because it validates that women who look like me are valued, whether that be in leadership, in the community, or in leading this city's future. Thank you, City Council, for recognizing our faith and our capability to show up fully as ourselves. Your support helps us build a city of inclusion with no limits, a place where everyone belongs. Thank you.
Great.
Good evening, City Council. It is a pleasure to be here tonight. My name is Spokmay Muklis, and I live in Iowa City. I came here from Afghanistan in 2023. Receiving this proclamation recognizing World Hijab Day means so much to us. It represents recognition and understanding for Muslim women in our city. Moments like this affirm that our voices and identities are valued in spaces that shape our shared future. For those who may not be familiar, the hijab is not just a piece of cloth. It is a meaningful part of how many Muslim women engage with the world, grounded in faith, responsibility, and personal conviction. For us, it is a source of strength, confidence, and a deep sense of identity. As a woman that wears hijab, too often we are underestimated, judged, or whispered about before anyone takes the time to understand us. People sometimes assume that covering means limitation, but choosing modesty does not make us any less capable, intelligent, or valued. I have learned that even a simple conversation, a question asked with curiosity, can dissolve assumption and open door to understanding. Those small moments are quietly powerful. This proclamation encourages dialogue, respect, and inclusion. It reminds Muslim women that they are seen, supported, and respected in our city. And it reminds our community that diversity is not something to be understood, not feared of. On behalf of Maryam Girls Club and Muslim women in Iowa City, thank you for issuing this proclamation and for helping build a community where every person is welcomed, respected, and free to be who they are and who they aspire to become. Thank you.
Great.
Good evening. My name is Fatima. I'm in 10th grade and I go to Liberty High School. And I've been a part of Maryam Girls Club since my freshman year of high school. And during this time, it has played a significant role in shaping my personal growth and values. Through the club, I have learned important stories and moral lessons connected to my faith, which have strengthened my understanding, resilience, and sense of responsibility. The Maryam Girls Club brings together girls from middle school through high school, so I'm always around girls who are in my age group. This creates a supportive and inclusive environment where I'm able to connect with peers who share similar experiences. These shared experiences, such as wearing the hijab and navigating identity, have helped us grow into more confident, faithful, and empowered young women. The club fosters a strong sense of belonging, and through our volunteer work and group activities, I have learned the importance of unity, service, and building meaningful connections with our broader community. Wearing the hijab is a personal and beautiful, meaningful journey. Through this journey, I have came to understand its deeper significance as an expression to my faith, modesty, and identity. By wearing it, I embrace my commitment to my beliefs and represent who I am as a proud Muslim female. I would like to extend my sincere gratitude to this Iowa City Council for proclaiming February 1st as World Hijab Day. The proclamation is a meaningful step forward, addressing misconceptions about hijabi women and promoting greater understanding and inclusion. It also serves as an important reminder of the tolerance, respect, and mutual understanding that strengthens our community, regardless of differences in faith. Our Muslim community, and the Maryam Girls Club in particular, is a valued and active part of Iowa City. On behalf of hijabi women everywhere, I express my heartfelt appreciation for the recognition, visibility, and demonstration to the World Hijab Day Proclamation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. Good evening, Mayor and Honorable Iowa City Council members. We are grateful to be back here once again as you consider the World Hijab Day Proclamation. Tonight is especially meaningful as it aligns with the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a day that calls us to honor justice, to honor dignity, and to honor liberation, and the courage to stand against injustice, whatever it is. Dr. King reminded us that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. That truth remains valid and alive today. Hijabi women and girls continue to experience prejudice, harassments, and oppression, often from those who claim to defend freedom and women's rights. Too often, our choice to live faithfully and modestly is misunderstood and attacked and ridiculed. Today's proclamation is a gift to the middle school girl in our community who just got bullied simply for choosing to wear the hijab. It is a gift to the hijabi girls in the Iowa City Community School District who have had their hijabs pulled off by peers. Acts rooted in misogyny and ignorance, in the belief that women must be molded into a single narrow image to be accepted. This proclamation is our way of saying clearly and unapologetically, we are here and we will stay here. We are determined to continue our journey by replacing ignorance with knowledge, fear with understanding, and hate with tolerance. I stand before you as a reminder of Fatima Al-Fihri. If you have never heard about her, she is a Muslim hijabi woman who founded the University of Al-Qarawiyyin, recognized as the first degree-granting university in the world, and a cornerstone of modern higher education. I stand before you as a reminder of Muslim women who contribute profoundly to science, navigation, knowledge, work that laid the foundation for technologies and which we depend on it today. And finally, I stand before you as a reminder of Mary, the mother of Jesus, peace be upon them both. The icon of faith and modesty, resilience, and honor, revered by billions across faiths, the modest woman who I am named the club after. This woman and countless others remind us that modesty have never been a barrier to greatness, only prejudice does. We ask our community to welcome and respect us for who we are, regardless of whether you personally accept us or not. Our principles and convictions are not weakened by rejections. Rather, rejection obstructs the coexistence and undermines the integrity of a community that we all belong to. Tonight, our youth showed up here to speak proudly, to stand up for what they believe in, and to witness their local government doing what is right for them. This proclamation is more than just words. It's a message that will echo through generations, telling our children that they belong, that they are protected, and that their city stands with them. To show support and to put this proclamation into practice, we invite you and the community to join us at the Celebration Choice World Hijab Day at the Iowa City Public Library on Saturday, January 31st, and also from 2 to 4, and also invite you to attend the World Hijab Day celebration at the Coralville Public Library. We are partnering with them this year again at the cafe from 1 to 3 on February 1st. These gatherings are opportunities to learn, to listen, to stand together in solidarity. Thank you for your leadership, the courage, and the commitment to justice in here. May Iowa City continue to be a place where diversity is not merely tolerated, but honored and practiced. Thank you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all. These youth are our leaders of today. Good to have you all here today. All right, we're going to move on to item number 3, which is a special presentation. 3A is Bird Friendly Iowa Dedication. And come on up at this time.
Yes, well, thank you. I want to first say I really appreciate the City Council making space for this topic on their agenda tonight. I know you have a full agenda ahead of you, so it's really meaningful that you are making the space to think about and talk about the value of birds in your community. My name is Erica Place, and I serve on the Steering Committee for Bird Friendly Iowa, which is an education and outreach program that works across the state to promote birds and conserve the habitats that they need. And we recognize communities who are doing an exceptional job at those things. So communities who are taking steps to protect and restore and enhance bird habitat in their communities, reducing threats to birds, like preventing window collisions, and educating and engaging people in birding and conservation in a variety of ways. And we feel that this is important because birds are more than just a beautiful thing to look at or to enjoy at your feeders. They are critical to everything from pest control, you know, in our agriculture fields, in our gardens, just in the environment in general. They are responsible for plant pollination, and they are indicators of how healthy the environment as a whole is. And as important as birds are, as intertwined as birds are with people, they are struggling due to a variety of factors, not just here in Iowa, but worldwide. There was a recent study done in North America specifically, and they found that there are 3 billion fewer individual birds in North America than there were in 1970. So in just 50 years, we've lost 3 billion individual birds. Their populations across species have shrunk by that much. So I really want to emphasize that the work being done in Iowa City matters. It matters to the birds that live here, it matters to the birds who migrate through here, and it makes an incredible difference. So we were thrilled to see Iowa City submit an application to become designated as bird friendly, and we were very impressed, to say the least. It was probably the most thorough application I have seen during my time on the steering committee, and it held just some really impressive achievements. And just to name a few, the city is doing an incredible job of encouraging native habitat and reduced chemical use on privately owned land. They're also doing an amazing job educating and engaging the public with birding hikes and other events that draw attention to birds and their value, and incorporating nature-based solutions throughout the city to address modern-day problems was also really impressive. So much so that we are lifting Iowa City up as an example for other communities in our communications that we put out throughout the state. Not only was Iowa City able to put together a really solid application to become designated, but it was so impressive that you also reached high flyer status, which is a level of achievement that is reserved for the communities that truly are going above and beyond. And it has, to my knowledge, never been given to a community at the time of designation. That's usually something that is achieved years down the road. So, all in all, just really want to impress upon you that there is great work being done in this community. I am thankful. Bird Friendly Iowa is thankful. Birds are thankful. And we're really pleased that you value this designation and wanted to pursue it. I think you had some things to say, too. Yeah.
And thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
All right. My name is Seth Dudley. I'm a member of the Iowa City Bird Club, and I work for the Iowa City Parks Department. I wanted to thank you, council members, for the opportunity to speak this evening. And without your support, this would not have been possible. I'd also like to thank Julie Seidel-Johnson, Director of Parks, and Rec, as well as Tyler Baird, the superintendent of the parks, for all their work and help with this project. I'd like to thank Erica for coming down here from Des Moines to be part of this, and for my committee members and the Iowa City Bird Club for all of their help. I'd just like to say a few words regarding this High Flyer certification that we have as a bird-friendly community. This designation is a validation of the hard work that the city, and in particular the Parks and Recreation Department, have put in over the last decade. This didn't happen overnight. It reflects years of thoughtful planning, stewardship, and commitment to our natural spaces. Some might ask why the certification matters. Simply put, what's good for the birds is good for us. Birds need clean air to breathe, fresh water to drink, nourishing food to eat, and open, healthy spaces to thrive. Those are the same things that human beings need. Our world is deeply interconnected, and by ensuring Iowa City is a healthy place for birds to raise their young, we are also ensuring it is a healthy place for our own children. In doing this work, we are taking care of future generations. The certification is also clear evidence that our tax dollars are working for the good of everyone who lives here, big and small. These investments benefit everyone who lives here, whether they notice it every day or not, from people to wildlife. They pay dividends far beyond their immediate purpose. For instance, Hickory Hill is a globally important bird area and one of the best places in the state to see migrating warblers in the spring. It is also a great place to take your dog for a walk or to take the kids sledding. Sycamore Greenway is home to breeding bald eagles, sandhill cranes, and ring-necked pheasants, but it's also the perfect spot to go for a bike ride after work. And at True Blood, you might be able to find migrating loons, avocets, or trumpeter swans, but you can also find the best sunsets in town. There's a lot of negativity in this world, and it's easy to focus on what feels broken or overwhelming. This recognition is proof that when a community works together, positive, meaningful change is possible. Small, consistent actions can make a big impact. Finally, this certification symbolizes what I believe makes Iowa City great. I feel privileged to not only call this community my home, but to also have the opportunity to work for the city and help be part of the solution. Thank you all for your hard work and support and your continuing efforts to make Iowa City a better place for all.
Great.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Seth, for sharing that. I also want to recognize two other folks who worked very hard on this application, Brenda and Linda here. And I have the pleasure of letting you know that you are officially designated as a bird-friendly community. And we'd love to get a picture to celebrate
absolutely.
The moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Council will come up here.
Yes. We'll come over here and take a picture.
Really appreciate this opportunity for us to be officially a bird-friendly designation. So thanks for everybody coming here to celebrate this today. All right, we're going to move on in our agenda with items 4 through 8, which is our consent agenda. Could I get a motion to approve, please?
Move, Sather.
Second, Burgess.
Anyone from the public like to address a topic on our consent agenda? If you're online, please raise your virtual hand. See no one in person or online. Council discussion. Roll call, please.
Weinlein?
Yes.
Alter?
Yes.
Burgess?
Yes.
Harmson?
Yes.
Moe?
Yes.
Sala?
Yes.
Teague?
Yes. Motion passes 7-0. Could I get a motion to accept correspondence for items 8B and 8C?
So moved, Weinlein.
Second, Moe.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes 7-0. We're at item number 9, which is community comment. This is an opportunity for people to address items that are not on our agenda. I wanted to see if there's anyone here today that wants to address an item that is not on our agenda. Please raise your hand. All right, great. We're going to allow you to have 3 minutes to speak, and just know that the council cannot engage in discussion or debate due to open meeting laws. Welcome. Please state your name and city you're from. There is a sign-in there. You can just drop that in the basket. Great.
Thank you.
And for anyone that's wanting to speak throughout today, there are some little papers that you can fill out and just drop it in the sign-in basket. So welcome. Please state your name and city you're from.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sydney Ullman, and I'm from Iowa City. I really appreciate the ability to speak with you all today. I am here to discuss the flock camera agreement with the University of Iowa Police Department. And so all of this information I'm going to talk about today is from my understanding. And one of the things I'm going to urge is more transparency from City Council. So if anything is incorrect, I really encourage sharing this more with the community, because I think there's a lot of confusion around the city's agreement with the university. So it's my understanding that this agreement with the University of Iowa took effect in 2023, and as far as I can tell, it has not been reviewed since then. It's also indefinite, so I don't see that there is a certain period at which it expires or at which the council is required to review the agreement to see if this is something that the city should continue with. It's also my understanding of the 28 Flock cameras I think we have in Iowa City right now, 22 of these, so the vast majority are in city right-of-ways. Looking at the terms of this agreement, the city can give written removal notice to the university, at which point the university would be required to remove the Flock cameras, again, the majority of which, you know, would be affected by this, within 10 calendar days. So when this was approved, it took effect in 2023. I do believe there were people who were talking about the harms. I do believe that a lot of the community would have been very concerned about the terms of this agreement. And I do know that the council has heard from people, from community members who want to ensure the safety of our neighbors and ensure a commitment with racial equity, social justice, and human rights and the other things that Iowa City has designated as priorities and as values. I also want to note in the terms of this agreement that the data is owned by the University of Iowa, which also sets the policies for how the data is used. And again, because this agreement is indefinite, if the planning of the, you know, locations of Flock cameras and stuff change, it's my understanding that that would go back to council. But how the data is used or shared does not require the council to review. And so I was looking at this. Per Flock's website, they have like a transparency website. The University of Iowa is sharing their data from these Flock cameras with almost 1,450 other entities across the U.S., sheriff's offices, police departments. I started counting. I lost count at like 700. And so I put it in my Google Docs and I tried to calculate. But yeah, almost 1,500 other entities across the U.S. also are being shared this data that's tracking Iowa City community members as we're seeking health care, as we're going to our employment, as we're trying to engage with our community and take care of our neighbors. This is continued harm. We need transparency. I highly recommend that the council put this on the agenda and address this. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hello.
Please state your name and city you're from.
My name is Abby Banks. I live here in Iowa City, and I'm also here to express my grave concern at the City of Iowa City's willingness to allow the University of Iowa Police Department to place 22 Flock automatic license plate readers on city right-of-ways. Although these cameras may not be managed or contracted directly with the city, I find this agreement performative and disingenuous at best and deceitful at worst. Section 9-11 of City Code Ordinance expressly outlaws the presence of automatic license plate readers. So to allow the university to maintain those ALPRs that you all claim to oppose on city property is like really deeply disturbing. According to the agreement between the city and university issued in December 2023, all you guys would have to do to terminate the use of Flock cameras on city right-of-ways would be to give written notice of removal to the university. Within 10 days, they have to be gone. That's it. Flock claims that they don't share data with organizations like ICE without the express permission of the organization that they contract with, which in this case would be the University of Iowa Police Department. But as we watch the Iowa Board of Regents slide farther and farther towards fascism, I fear that it's only a matter of time before that becomes our reality. Furthermore, while Flock doesn't have a direct contract with ICE, like Sydney said, the University of Iowa's contract grants data access to over 1,400 organizations. What about those municipalities and organizations? Did you check with each and every single one of them to make sure that their data sharing practices prohibits cooperations with the very agencies that are violently disappearing our neighbors? Ultimately, every day we hear of red lines being crossed when it comes to ICE. We never let them do X. It's not legal for them to do Y. They don't care. So I'm begging you to care. Why would we give them a potential tool to surveil us and our neighbors further? I've seen many of you at protests, speaking out on social media and on the campaign trail opposing ICE. This is your opportunity to do that. The best time to end this agreement would have been December 23rd, 2023. The second best time is now. I again ask you to please stand on the side of community support and safety, to follow your own city ordinances, and to terminate the agreement with the University of Iowa to allow flock cameras on city right-of-ways. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else like to address a topic not on our agenda? Seeing no one, going to close community comment. We're going to move on to items 10, which is planning and zoning matters. 10A, zoning code and text amendment, state preemptions, ordinance amending Title 14 zoning to ensure compliance with changes in state law related to home occupations, consumer fireworks sales, exterior building materials, variances, and accessory dwelling units. I'm going to open up the public hearing. And welcome, Danielle.
Thank you, Mayor. Danielle Sisman, Neighborhood and Development Services. As you introduced this, this is a zoning code text amendment item. It's really just, I'm going to give you a quick briefing of some of the mandatory code changes that we need to make in order to comply with state laws. Over the past 4 years, there's been a kind of a backlog of items that while we've complied with the state law, we haven't put it on the books. We've been certainly implementing things as we needed to. This is cleanup to go through these five items and accomplish that. All of these items are things that the state took upon itself to remove from our control, preempt city local control. And so basically, these are just aligning our code with the what we are allowed to do. So I'll go through each one of these and just give you the highlights of what it meant and what it impacts. So the first one is related to home occupations. This basically was a state law allowing more home occupations and more zones and more ways. So the impact to this city is that basically we're not allowed to do require permits for most of these. There are more allowed employees on site in home occupations, a home occupation being an occupation that occurs in someone's dwelling. It's expanded where the home occupation can be. It can now be outside in some cases in a side or rear yard. It expanded the footprint inside the building to 50% of the principal dwelling's floor area. It also allowed commodities, so the sale of goods from a home. So we adjusted our city code to accommodate that. We've been implementing that since it came out in 2022. Honestly, the volume of home occupations is fairly low, so it's not a super impactful change to us, but it was something that we have had to track. The next one is consumer fireworks sales. This was the one that basically told cities that they must allow the sale of consumer fireworks in both commercial and industrial zoning districts. The city previously did not allow anything except for in industrial, so this allows for sales. It does not really impact anything other than the zoning district in which the sale can occur. We still have the things that we do to ensure that those fireworks stands are safe and that it's being published that those should not be set off in the city. The next one has to do with exterior design materials for residential buildings. This code change was basically...
I have one question before you go off the last one.
Sure.
Are there requirements of when the city can say when fireworks can be set off?
So,
yes.
But that's not a part of this.
I'm sorry?
But that's not a part of this?
It's not part of the zoning code ordinance. Okay, the state law limited, actually, in fact, I think that some of the sales dates are listed there in Ms. Sitzman's slide. But, yes, the city has control other than having to allow during the dates that are spelled out by state code.
Do we have any restrictions on quantity of fireworks that you can have, and is that something that we're allowed to regulate?
No.
You can have as many fireworks in a big pile as you want in a commercial
As long as they're consumer fireworks, yes.
Oh, my.
Mayor Teague, were you asking if there is regulations on time of day?
Yes. Yeah, so the state came with specific days when fireworks can be set off.
That's correct. There are also some time limitations as well. I do not have those committed to memory.
Okay.
But, for example, one of the days where it's allowed is January 1st, and I think it goes till 12:01 a.m.
Okay. I guess my question would be, do we need to change any of that in our language?
Oh, I don't believe so, but I'd be happy to check.
Okay, great. Thanks.
The next is exterior design materials for residential buildings. This is a code change that affects buildings that are 12 dwelling units or fewer. We don't really have that occur. This was targeted mostly at making sure that cities were not imposing material requirements on single-family homes, which we certainly do not. We did have on the books some requirements for materials for apartment buildings, but we don't see apartment buildings in this 12 or fewer number of units category. So again, not a huge impact on the city's regulations. But we did have to make sure that our code calls that out specifically, since the 12 units is now the cutoff point. We do have the ability to still require certain materials in certain zoning districts, because they are special zoning districts that are intended to regulate that. The intent of the state code was really to address single-family homes that were not in special zoning districts. So our overlay districts and our special zoning districts can still have design materials, and we can still regulate them on apartment buildings larger than 12 units. The next code change is related to area variances. So the city has had use variances on the books. We did need to add the distinction that now there's another kind of variance that can be applied for, which is that to a measurement, such a variance to an area, dimension, or other numerical limitation. So not a variance for a use, but a variance for a minor adjustment, basically, to a standard. The criteria then needed to be added to our code that the state said would be the right review criteria for an area variance, and that is the practical difficulties standard. So we've added that to our code as well. Use variances are harder to obtain because you've got a lot of really specific criteria about hardship. This does not include that hardship standard. It's more of a practical standard. The next code change is related to accessory dwelling units. The state did follow our lead, honestly, and include statewide legislation that all cities should allow ADUs, accessory dwelling units, at least one on every lot where a single-family residence is allowed. It then also did prohibit cities from having restrictions on those ADUs, such as owner occupancy or parking requirements or size limitations and design standards. We had not quite gone as far as this in our own code changes, so we still had a renter owner restriction. The state has preempted us from doing that, so now a rental unit can also have a rental ADU. Basically, there's also a limitation on discretionary review, so making the process of getting a permit or to build an accessory dwelling unit is intended to be streamlined. So our code changes were in 2023, where we removed minimum parking requirements and then allowed ADUs to be developed with single-family homes. We also adjusted the sizes. What we needed to do now is adjust our sizing again to meet the state's requirements for how large of an ADU can be allowed on a lot. The state also uses its own definition of what single-family means, and so when we compared their definition of single-family to ours, it basically translates into duplexes and townhomes would be considered single family per the state code. So we needed to call that out as well. Mm-hmm. And I said the size adjustment, basically the ADU cannot exceed 1,000 square feet or 50% of the single family resident, whichever is larger. So that's a little bit larger than what we had anticipated. I will say the previews, it sounds like maybe ADUs will come back into the state consideration again, so we may be adjusting these yet again if they preempt or tinker with their ordinance. So as I said, these are state law changes that have been in effect since 2023 to present. We're functionally implementing them according to state law. What we proposed tonight were the least amount of changes to our code to comply with the code, so we simply are implementing what's been handed to us by the state. The Planning and Zoning Commission recommended approval of these amendments at their December meeting by a vote of 5-1, and I'm happy to answer more questions if you have them.
The size of the ADUs that had to be modified, the SF-592 version, do we still get to retain our own setback requirements, right? Like if you're in a small lot size, even though you might have a minimum or a maximum size large, you'd still have to have a setback?
Right.
Okay.
Assuming everything else works.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the owner-occupied requirement that we had here in the city, that was simply for the north side, wasn't it?
No, that was
citywide. It was
citywide.
All? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. My memory is serving me false. Thanks.
And the ADUs, can they be two-level?
So an ADU could be either inside the existing home or separate. So you could have a basement ADU, an attic ADU, an addition ADU, or it's completely detached.
Understand. Thank you. All right, no other questions for you. Would anyone from the public like to address this topic? If you're in council chambers, please come forward. If you're online, please raise your hand.
Mayor, while the public is considering comment, I want to clarify the fireworks comments I made a moment ago. It looks like we may need to do some cleanup on dates and times in our ordinance.
Great, thank you.
We'll do so.
Mm-hmm. Anyone from the public like to address this topic during this public hearing? Seeing no one in person or online, before I close the public hearing, wondering if council is inclined to vote with PNZ? Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing. Could I get a motion to give first consideration, please?
So moved, Harmson.
Second, Wyline.
All right, council discussion.
I understand that these seem to make sense to a certain degree. The fireworks is a little beyond me, but I guess I just want to say it's frustrating that we continue to have pieces of home rule whittled away from us. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah.
Agree.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
Roll call, please.
Alter?
Yes.
Burgess?
Yes.
Harmson?
Yes.
Moe?
Yes.
Sala?
Yes.
Teague?
Yes.
Wyline?
Yes.
Motion passes 7-0. Item number 11 is our regular formal agenda, 11A, Iowa City Landfill Compost Facility Improvements and Expansion Project, Resolution Approving Project Manual and Estimate of Cost for the Construction of the Iowa City Landfill Compost Facility Improvements and Expansion Project, Establishing Amount of Bid Security to Accompany Each Bid, Directing City Clerk to Post Notice to Bidders, and Fixing Time and Place for Receipt of Bids. I'm going to open up the public hearing and welcome Joe.
Joe Welter Engineering. I'm just trying to get my presentation on the laptop here real quick.
All good.
Oh, if it wants to do that. Okay. Just open it off the thumb drive. So, thank you. Just a little bit of background information first. For those that don't know, the landfill out on the west side of town, actually just outside of our property limits or edge of town or our municipal limits. Once you scale down into the landfill site there, the main campus and just east of the main campus, east of our new building, is the compost pad. The current area is there highlighted in blue. It's about 5 acres. The expansion area is about 2 acres. It's off to the east of that in the green. And so the current site has a lot of concerns, a lot of challenges. The conditions at the site, regulatory compliance is always an issue at the landfill. We have a separate permit now for our compost operations. It's separate from our landfill operations. It has some very specific language in it about how we maintain the compost, how we maintain stormwater. Our existing pad is in compliance, but it has challenges that we're hoping to improve. There's a general lack of space now in our operations and for the interactions between the customers and our people that are working on the pad. It gets really congested. The traffic flow really gets congested, and sometimes there isn't a lot of space out there. As you can, we'll see in the subsequent slide, there's quite a bit of our pavement on the pad that's failing. The processing areas are a little bit small for our current operations, and there's just inadequate stormwater management in our current facility. So these are some pictures of our current pad. You can see how we have areas that are just basically falling apart. You know, we've run out of asphalt in those areas. We're just putting rock in there. Not real ideal for our compost operations. So we have this great project planned. We're going to improve the stormwater system. We're redoing the entire stormwater system. We're adding a stormwater treatment unit that's going to take our first flush and our smaller storm events through it and get all of the pollutants out before it gets out into our new detention basin, which is then going to settle out the remainder of the pollutants and help us really maintain our compost operations of stormwater off of it better than we ever have before. There's going to be new pavement across the entire pad, the original 5 acres plus the 2 acres that we're expanding into. It'll be a mix of concrete and asphalt and then some reclamation material. We're going to take some of the material that's already out there, grind it all up, compact it down, and then put a small asphalt overlay over that. So it's consistent with our goals at the site to reuse material and to be sustainable about our materials. Expansion, as I said, is another 2 acres. We're also expanding what we want to do with the site and the operations that we have. So in the first year after construction, we want to take in an extra 1,000 tons of compost material. In the second year, 5,000. Third year, another 5,000. Eventually, we want to increase that from our current 15,000 up to 35,000. So it's a substantial increase that we're doing. There's a picture of our new turner. We got trained on this this past year, and we're using it. The staff has nicknamed it Tina. So, so she's got a name. We're also really have some operational goals that we want. So we're reaching out to get increased participation with grocery stores, 50% more material from them by 2028. Our restaurants, we're trying to reach out to them and get 50% more material from them also in 2028. And we want to provide compost to 100% of our community gardens throughout Johnson County. Again, because the landfill serves Johnson County, all of Johnson County, plus Riverside and Kelowna. We're also, right now, it takes us at least a year, sometimes more, to process material from the time we receive it to the time it's ready for people to pick it up, whether that be commercial or residential users. And with the turner and with the new operations, we're hoping to get that down to 3 to 4 months. So a substantial increase in the amount of material we can move through the pad and the time it takes us to process that. This is consistent with the goals that you have set for staff and the goals that you've set for our community, starting with the Climate Action and Adaptation Plan in 2018, the 2022 Accelerated Iowa City Climate Actions. Those two documents talk about increasing our composting of organics and engaging the public to compost organic waste. The 2022 Statewide Material Characterization Study, which is done by a consultant for the DNR, showed that in 2022, we had 24% of our waste were organics in our landfill versus 22%, which is the statewide average. So we're above the statewide average in the amount of organics going into our landfill. So diverting that waste to compost is going to be a very is going to meet a lot of our objectives that we have both in the climate action plans and also in your strategic plan. So specifically in the strategic plan, just took one quote out of there. There's several other places that talk about this topic, but a focus on resilience of the community in the face of climate change. So this is a very good way that we're trying to be more resilient in what we're doing at the landfill, but also being better stewards of where those materials should end up. So it's an estimated $3.8 million. $4 million of that's coming from our EPA grant that we got. That is an EPA grant, Solid Waste Infrastructure for Recycling. It's called SWIFR. It's a grant program. It's a new program. And so there haven't been very many SWIFR projects yet. So engineering staff's a little bit apprehensive how the whole process is going to work out, but we're confident that it's going to be a great project. DNR also gave us a small grant to help us with the cost of the turner. Didn't cover the whole cost, but it helped with that somewhat. My contact information is there. Shive Hattery is our consultant, our design team on this project, did an excellent job with this. Really excited to get the contractor hired and get going on this. Construction starts in April, and we should be done in August. Okay. Any questions?
Regarding the goal of decreasing the amount of organics in the landfill and getting them in the compost pile or great, we're adding more capacity, but what's the plan to get more people to participate in the composting program and to get those organics out of the landfill?
Yeah, so we have a bunch of outreach that is part of our grant. So we're reaching out to schools and restaurants and grocery stores and all those kinds of things to try to work with existing haulers. So we're not going to be hauling this organic waste ourselves, but we're going to be working with them to make arrangements to get their waste to us so that we can process that through our composting process.
Through the study that you guys, that third party does for the DNR, can you identify where that organic waste is coming from, whether it's residential or commercial?
Well, I mean, we have a little bit of a thought because we keep track of what comes across the scale. We know what vendors are haul organic wastes, and so we have a little bit of thought on that. But really, what that waste characterization is doing is it picks a bunch of sites around the state. We've been picked the last two times. It's done every 5 years, so it'll be done again in 2027. And they take random loads, and they start separating it out and characterize what the wastes are. Hmm. So it's not a real enjoyable process to watch, but it does sort of give us a benchmark of where we stand versus other communities and versus versus the state averages.
And then with this 2-acre expansion and a desire to move from landfill to this organic, to the compost pile, how much time does this project allow for expansion, or what's the future proofing this project provides, or when will we need to be adding on to the compost pile again?
Probably many, many, many years in the future. So not only are we adding that 2 extra acres to give us some more room for where we're doing our processing, where we're interacting with the users of the site, the customers of the site, but also that increasing that processing time. So we're not waiting a whole year to go from wood waste and organics and different things like that to finish composting. That process will get down to more 3 to 4 months, so that we're not sitting on material waiting to cook and waiting to process. That's equally as important as the 2 acres that we're adding.
Okay. Thanks.
Real quick.
And there was staggered goals in there. So you see, we're not trying to get to the 20,000 tons 2 weeks after we're done with the compost pad project. We're doing that in a staggered fashion, you know, 5,000, 5,000, 10,000, up to that 20,000.
Real quick, thank you. This is great. One of the questions that popped up during your presentation, you mentioned needing the stormwater improvements because of pollutants and filtering that out. What pollutants come from this stream? Is there something involving with people not throwing away carefully enough, or what are we talking about?
It'd be the same kind of pollutants that we might see in lots of other stormwater runoff around town. So anything that's, you know, small pieces of the compost to larger chunks of dirt or debris or different things like that. So we're not thinking about plastics or something like that. We do have a little bit of that sometimes, but that's not so much the concern because we grind the material and we process the material. And so it's more stormwater comes, you get a big, heavy storm event. Those are going to go through a bypass, but the smaller, regular events are going to go through a treatment unit. Which is a pretty standard practice, but we don't have that currently. So that's a huge improvement for
Thank
the
you.
Facility.
That makes sense. Thanks.
I remember a few months ago when we got that really good presentation at a work session. I believe it was a work session from Waste Management. And I was kind of blown away about how much food waste goes into the landfill, you know. So it's great that we're expanding capacity and increasing outreach to try to increase people to compost. I was wondering, because just out of ignorance, what does the city provide in terms of residential composting? I'm just not entirely sure.
Big yellow bin.
There's 2 different bins that people can have access to, and the yard waste bin can have yard waste plus compost material in it. And so then we have a regular, basically, solid waste bin that people put out on the curb. But then they have newer bins that have single stream recycling and also a separate container then for their yard waste slash composting.
Okay. I was just wondering if there was going to be – I just saw that, which I think are the things that – should be looking into first, like the big compost makers. But in terms of residential outreach, looking at what we provide, because we have more capacity, because we really want to decrease what's in the landfill. If any thought's gone into that, looking at our policies of the prices, if that's something that the council would want to look in the future, I'd be happy to. Yeah.
We're asking questions to Joe.
Yeah, right, I know. It started as a question, then turned into commentary when I realized I shouldn't ask him a question like that.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you much. Anyone from the public like to address this topic? If so, please come forth if you're in council chambers. Seeing no one in person or online, because no one's online. I'm going to close the public hearing. Can I get a motion to give approval, please?
So moved. Alter.
Second, Sally.
All right. Council discussion.
I think this is practical investment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That support like sustainability goals that we, mm-hmm. our sustainability goals. And I think investment like this will make sure that the facility continue to serve our community effectively.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I also just love seeing the words $4 million grant. Yeah, it's great to see.
Yes. Well, and what that signifies is the work that was done to apply for the grant, the city staff mm-hmm. work behind all of that and mm-hmm. the planning and stuff. So, yeah, to see this actually, we've been talking about this for a while. This has been in process for a while, and to be at this stage is exciting.
We're great mm-hmm. at filling out applications and grants. The bird application was a hit. Yeah. This one also.
Yeah. And I will echo the thanks to the staff for all their hard work at seeing this opportunity. And this honestly speaks to our strategic goals mm-hmm. and strategic plans that they continue to look at and just move the city closer to reaching all of those. So thanks again to the city staff. Really appreciate it. And I would agree, $4 million is a phenomenal grant, as well as the DNR $100,000 grant. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate that opportunity. All right. Mm-hmm. Roll call, please.
Burgess?
Yes.
Harmson?
Yes.
Moe?
Yes.
Sella?
Yes.
Teague?
Yes.
Wyline?
Yes.
Alter?
Yes.
Motion passes 7-0. We're on to item number 11B. This is alcohol license suspending hearing, Field House Bar and Grill. Resolution finding the Field House Bar and Grill violated section 4-2-2. Parenthesis B of the city code by serving alcohol on floors other than the ground floor without qualifying for an exception, allowing service and consumption on more than the ground floor level, and imposing a 14-day alcohol license suspension under city code section 4-2-5, parenthesis C, parenthesis 1, and parenthesis C, parenthesis 4. All right. The city attorney will be presenting the case, so we'll have Assistant Johnson County Attorney David Van Compernol, who is here to advise the council. So welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Great. All right. So we're going to move to a motion, which is number one, for a continuance distributed in the 120 late handouts. The petitionee's motion and presented and presentation for continuance. Maybe we'll have some commentary on that at this time.
Yeah, so I think yesterday afternoon, Permittees Council made a request to postpone the hearing that was scheduled for this evening. I am not the decision maker, you all are, and so my advice was to put it on the agenda before any potential hearing so you could take argument from both sides and decide whether you want to grant that extra time or not. But that's sort of why that is there.
Okay. First, I want to go ahead and accept correspondence. Could I get a motion to accept correspondence?
So moved.
The late handout.
Second.
Moved by Mo, seconded by Salah. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes 7-0. So the motion before us that we just, well, what we just heard is the late handout, which is requesting a continuation and not for us to hear this tonight. I guess we can have some discussion questions at this time from council, should there be any at this time.
Mr. Mayor, if I may, perhaps hear from the permittee first and the city attorney's response. And then sure. You can ask questions back and forth of the parties before you render your decision.
All right, great. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council. My name is Eric Hartman, and I represent the permittee in this matter. We submitted this request because the city has filed dueling municipal infraction allegations against my client, both in Johnson County District Court and in front of the council, alleging violations of city code, both of which involve the same facts and circumstances, and both of which we assert allege involve similar issues of whether application of this ordinance would violate state law and whether or not my client is acting as a restaurant. We believe it would be appropriate, since this matter is subject to judicial review, we think it would be prudent to wait for the court's determination. This matter is presently, or not this matter, the competing Johnson County District Court citation is set for hearing on February 25th. So we think it would be prudent to continue the matter to hear the court's ruling on our arguments at that time before we decide the matter before the council.
Any questions by council at this time? Hearing none. Well, I don't know if the city has any response to this you would like to share.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor. My name is Liz Craig. I'm an assistant city county or city attorney for Iowa City. The city does want to go forward and suggest that you should go forward with the hearing tonight. This has been scheduled since December 3rd of 2025. The issue in the municipal infraction court case is different than the issue that you're looking at today. The municipal infraction was issued for a zoning violation, and that has to do with where drinking establishments can be located in relation to each other. And the issue that you're asked to decide tonight is whether the field house obtained an alcohol license in 2025 and represented that it would be operating as a restaurant and that it should not have been able to obtain an alcohol license for all three floors of 138 South Clinton Street by representing that it would operate as a restaurant and then not operate as a restaurant. So those are different issues. The resolution of one is not going to resolve the other one. So it's the city's position that it's appropriate to go forward on the alcohol suspension hearing tonight.
Great. Thank you. Any questions by council? Thank you. All right. Council, any... if there are no questions, could I get a motion to continue hearing to March 11th, 2026? So just like with anything, there's a motion, and then we'll be able to come and vote.
Or if nobody makes a motion, then it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Correct?
Correct. So is there a motion to continue the hearing to March 11th, 2026? Is there a motion to continue the hearing to March 11th, 2026?
No.
Hearing none, motion fails. We're going to move on to item number two, which is the hearing, and then we'll just ask for the city to come at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Again, I'm Liz Craig, and I'm an assistant city attorney. I'm going to give you a brief overview about the legal background for this hearing tonight. The city manager's here, and Lieutenant Rob Cash from the Iowa City Police Department are also here if you have additional questions. First, I want to point out an error to you in the exhibits. There's an exhibit that's labeled Exhibit 16 and says it's a Daily Iowan article. It's actually an email from November 7th. From the city manager to Mr. Barklow and Mr. Hughes. I just wanted to make that clear to you in case you're clicking through your exhibits tonight as I give my presentation. The legal issue in front of you tonight is whether the field house violated city ordinances by obtaining a license to sell and serve alcohol on all three floors of 138 South Clinton Street when it is not operating as a restaurant, as it said it would when it obtained its alcohol license in January of 2025. Iowa City Code 422B is a public safety regulatory requirement involving the premises of liquor licenses. It says that in general, unless a business qualifies as a certain type, such as a restaurant, it can't obtain a liquor license for more than the ground floor of a building. This is because it's more difficult to quickly and effectively respond to emergencies in buildings with multiple floors, and public safety incidents happen more often in bars versus restaurants, hotels, theaters, and businesses whose primary function is something other than the service of alcohol. The facts and the timeline of the field house obtaining an alcohol license for all three floors are outlined in my memo. There are three phases that are important here. Number one was the approval of the building permit for a new restaurant and bar in November 2024 for the old Active Endeavors building, 138 South Clinton Street. The second is the approval of the alcohol license in January of 2025, almost exactly a year before tonight. And number three is the actual operation of the field house since it opened on November 6th of 2025. During the building permit stage, starting in the spring of 2024, city staff explained that this space would have to be a restaurant in order to have an alcohol license on all three floors. And if you look at Exhibit 2, you can see notes that Building Inspection Services staff put on the plans for one of the initial plans that set forth the entire definition of a restaurant. Plans for a restaurant and bar were approved in November of 2024 with a kitchen that was deemed adequate for a menu that was provided by the field house, and that was a full menu that had appetizers, salads, sandwiches, and desserts, and you can look at that menu at Exhibit 3. The photo in the field house's exhibits shows the three compartment sinks that are required to meet the definition of a restaurant kitchen, which was a requirement that staff pointed out during the building permit process. When the corporate owner of the field house applied for a liquor license in January of 2025, it was again represented to city staff that this would be a restaurant. The building plans that had been approved in November were attached to the license application and included all three floors. Staff again informed the licensee that this would have to be a restaurant to have an alcohol license that covered all three floors. The alcohol license was recommended for approval by staff on the basis that it would be a restaurant. The field house opened on November 6th of 2025. Under Iowa City Code 411, which defines restaurant, it has not operated as a business whose primary function is the service of food to customers, which is the definition of a restaurant. Officers who have been in the premises have never seen a food being served or evidence of food service. Officers have been there at various times in the evening, in November on 5 occasions, in December 10 times, and have been there on 8 occasions in January so far. Officers have never seen a food menu. There's a document that says it's a menu in the packet of exhibits that the field house submitted tonight. But officers have never actually seen a menu on the premises, and recently social media does not reveal the menu that we found were given in the packet as well. So it'll be new information to find out where that menu is actually located. As recent as January 16, when asked by an officer about what food was available, a bartender read what types of pizza were available off of the registered computer screen. But no physical menu was handed over to the officer at that time, and none could be seen. Fieldhouse staff has said that they don't have servers, and on at least one occasion, the bar staff was working as the kitchen staff, bar staff, and the door person. There's no dispute that the Fieldhouse has an adequate kitchen to be a restaurant, and you can see those sinks in the Fieldhouse's exhibits, but an adequate kitchen is just one factor in what makes a restaurant under the city's definition of a restaurant under 411. The business must still actually operate as a restaurant. The hours of food service available have been inconsistent and have not reached the 60% threshold that's required by the ordinance. The Fieldhouse advertises as being open from 6 o'clock p.m. and closing at 2 a.m., but staff has said the kitchen closes at 10 p.m. Once staff said that it opens at 9 p.m., there have been inconsistent hours of operation for the restaurant service. You can take a look at the social media posts and press articles that are in your exhibits from Exhibit 14 to 17. The Fieldhouse holds itself out as a bar, does not hold itself out as a restaurant. There's occasionally ads about pizza and hot dogs available. This evening, our office received a picture that was a poster, appears to be in the Fieldhouse window for $12 pizzas. But the test is whether the primary function is food service. And it's clear, I think, from the factors in 411 that the primary function is not food service. You can ask the Fieldhouse representatives tonight about the specifics of their restaurant business. For example, what are the days and hours that the kitchen is open? Where can customers find the food service menu? How does food get served with no servers? What percentage of sales comes from food? But tonight, the city's asking council to decide that the Fieldhouse has violated local ordinances in obtaining a liquor license for all three floors of 138 South Clinton Street because it's not operating as a restaurant as it represented. The suspension of the alcohol license requested is for 14 days, which is the time frame that staff has estimated would take to allow the Fieldhouse to transition its business from a bar to a restaurant, and also provide accountability for previous violations. During that time, the Fieldhouse would be able to be open and conduct other lawful business, such as selling food, but it could not sell, serve, or allow the consumption of alcohol. Council's suspension, if it chooses to impose one, may be appealed by the Fieldhouse to the Department of Revenue, and the suspension would not go into effect until after that appeal had taken place. And the Department of Revenue, which is now has the alcohol division in it, will hold its own hearing as well. Once again, the city recommends suspension, a 14-day suspension of the Fieldhouse's alcohol license. And I'm happy to take questions.
Did you say that the 14-day suspension would not go in effect until after, if an appeal was done, after that was resolved?
That's correct, yeah.
I can actually go through the evidence myself through the memos, but do you have an estimate of how many times, and this is in the early process with city staff, when there's the application to become a restaurant to get the how many times staff talked about this is for what needs to happen for you to be a restaurant because there are three floors? You mentioned that early in your presentation, and right. I'm just wondering if there's an estimate of the summary of how many times staff.
Well, certainly, I think there's an email in the exhibits that staff informs the owners of the Fieldhouse that it's going to have to be a restaurant if it's going to have a liquor license. Then again, it's on some plans mm-hmm. set forth in full right. by Building Inspection Services. There was In January 2025, there was a letter by the city attorney's office after the city actually received the application for the liquor license that said, if this is going to be on all three floors, it's going to need to operate as a restaurant. In July 2025, this would have been still before the opening of the field house. The city manager did send a letter once again reiterating that point. And then November 7th, which was the day after the field house opened, once again, the city manager did send an email to the field house with the same information.
Thank you for the summary.
So the 14-day suspension, if that, if it's passed today, certainly there could be an appeal. And if there's an appeal, then that 14-day suspension is halted, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
One. Yeah. Can you explain the appeal? Like, when you say appeal, it just means, like, they just appeal again and prove that they are a restaurant and you give them the license back. That's what it is?
So it would be an appeal of the suspension that, that council has imposed to the Department of Revenue, which is formerly the ABD.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And is then there is a process that occurs at the Department of Revenue where they make their own determination about the suspension decision. So this...
Okay, then my question will be, this suspension, I just want to understand, this suspension now for 14 days... And after that, if they prove they are like a restaurant, they have menu, they have everything, they can have the license back?
Or? Yes, it's just a suspension. It's not a revocation of the alcohol license.
Okay. Sure.
And if at the end of the 14 days, if they're not operating as a restaurant, as the code or the their application from what we see right now has indicated, at the end of the 14 days, let's say there was no appeal, mm-hmm. what happens at that point?
I think that we would have to evaluate the facts and circumstances that existed at the time to see if there would need to be additional enforcement action taken, if I'm understanding your question, Mayor.
Sure. So at the end of the 14-day, we're allowing time for them to be, essentially become a restaurant and show the evidence. But at the end of the 14 days, if that doesn't take place, then does it just end? And they get their they get to operate within their license because this council would have only allowed it for 14 days. Is there something that we should be considering should they not come into compliance?
Right. So I think if you approve the 14-day suspension tonight, it will only be for 14 days. You could approve a suspension for longer than that, but I think whatever suspension you do approve tonight, that's going to be the amount of time, and there won't be the ability later on to, like, extend it. You know, if staff goes in, I think we would probably have to take additional enforcement action at that point.
Okay.
I just have a quick, I guess, fact question. As I look at the building permit application, I see, or excuse me, the permit plans, I see lots of tables and chairs, which is kind of a hallmark of a place that serves food. Mm-hmm. I can't tell from the social media photos, are those tables and chairs in the space with, like, menus and food service on them? Or
We haven't seen evidence of tables and chairs with menus and food service. There are high-top bar tables. Not traditional dining seating like you would expect at a restaurant.
Does it match even close to what's in the application?
I have not gone through to match up table for table exactly what's there. I can tell you there are tables within the establishment, but it's not dining seating like you might see at a sit-down restaurant, you know.
Okay.
Just a couple things just to make sure for complete clarity. When city staff about a year ago, I think you said this, I just want to nail it down. City staff gave us the recommendation for us to pass this liquor license that we did pass. That was based on things like the menu that was listed as one of the exhibits that lists a what you would think of as a typical restaurant menu, right? Not just two or three items, but a full menu, correct?
Right. So the city receives the alcohol application. Mm-hmm. We didn't receive a menu as part of the alcohol application. The menu was received as part of the building permit process to make sure that the field house had an adequate kitchen to run a restaurant.
Right. Okay.
And so those plans were then approved for the restaurant in November of 2024. And those plans were attached to the alcohol application in January of 2025. And that's what city staff recommended for approval for all three floors of that space.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
If we had known that the circumstances as they exist today if we'd known it was going to play out this way, would staff have recommended the issuance of the liquor license for multiple floors?
No. The application was approved and recommended by staff to be approved based on the representations that this would be a restaurant. And I think that's where the menu becomes important. Staff was presented with a menu during the building permit process that appeared to be a full restaurant menu. And if staff had known that there wouldn't be food service, that was the primary function of this business, staff wouldn't have recommended approval of the alcohol license application because, at that point, or at least not for the three floors, at that point, the field house would not have been in compliance with the premises requirement in 422B.
And at that time, it was called New Restaurant, not Field House.
It was not called the Field House at that time, but the corporate owner has remained the same throughout.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here are no other questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. We'll invite you up to speak at this time.
Thank you, Mayor. As I mentioned before, my name is Eric Hartman, and I represent the permittee in this matter. The field house has been an Iowa City institution for a long time, and my client has put in a significant amount of resources and effort to revive it. The city simply cannot suspend its alcohol license tonight because it's been operating as a restaurant, contrary to the claims of the city's attorney. We submitted today a few documents that I believe you've reviewed. I just want to run through some of these. I agree that a business whose primary function is the service of food to customers is what's required, and quite frankly, the field house does that. The first factor is whether it prepares meals on the premises and provides meal services to each floor. Here we've that's moving fast. Here we've got a floor plan showing we've got three floors. The field house provides meal service to every floor. The food is served on all floors while the kitchen is open. The second factor is whether there's a food service menu from which customers may order. Yes, a different menu was submitted when the application was made, but there's no requirement that that menu stay exactly the same or that that menu can't change. A different owner submitted the application, and the business was sold. So the items on the menu changed to account for supply and demand, as any business may work. And if you look, here's a copy of the menu. I'm advised that the hot dog baskets are being released about now. My client is here and can take questions on that if there are more questions. The next factor is having an employee whose primary duty is preparation of food and whose primary duty is to serve food to customers. The field house has such employees. There's always one person scheduled whose primary duty is to prepare food, and there's always a person scheduled whose primary duty is to serve food. That doesn't mean that's all those people are doing. That doesn't mean they can't do other things. The next factor is whether there's a kitchen separate from the bar and whether there's 2-3 compartment sinks. We meet that. The next factor is whether there's restaurant service operating during at least 60% of the hours the business is open to the public. Again, the field house meets that. It sells food from when it opens, I believe, until 1:30 in the morning.
The next factor is whether it holds itself out to be a restaurant and advertises itself as a restaurant. I guess I would start this by noting that no restaurant simply advertises food. Every restaurant makes significant revenue from the sale of alcoholic beverages. So the expectation is not that the restaurant or the field house advertises no based on no alcohol. The expectation instead should be, does it advertise similarly to other similarly situated restaurants in the area? And it does. If you look at, this is a little zoomed out here, but we've got a picture on the field house's Instagram page advertising pizza, various flavors. Again, we've got a picture advertising hot dog baskets. And again, we've got more advertisements showing food. The last factor is whether there's a cafe or a lunchroom. And if you look at the plans, it's clear that, as Councilman Moe was asking earlier, that there are areas for food service, and food service is happening there. I guess, secondly, there are a few legal issues with the council's request to suspend the liquor license. I don't have a copy of it here with me today, but Iowa Code Section 123.39, subsection 2, does give local authorities the power to adopt ordinances or regulations for the location of retail alcohol license establishments, and but that's limited to the to say that those ordinances cannot diminish the hours during which alcoholic beverages may be sold. And we believe that the city code in this case, section 4-2-2 and 14-4A-4F, are irreconcilable with state law because our client is a restaurant, and those code sections prohibit restaurants from selling alcohol on each floor between midnight and 2 a.m., which contravenes section 123.392 and code section 364.3, which again prohibits cities from issuing standards and requirements that are more stringent than those imposed by state law. And another legal issue in this case is that the city approved the Class C liquor license, in this case, to three floors of the premises. And the city here is seeking to enforce section 4-2-2B, saying that restaurants, but not drinking establishments, drinking establishments, but not restaurants, can operate on multiple floors. And if you look at the state code, section 123.3 sub 29 provides that a licensed premises includes all the rooms, all the floors, all of it. And by trying to enforce 4-2-2B, the city is wrongfully seeking to prevent my client from serving alcohol on all floors of the premises. And again, that is contrary to the scheme contemplated by section 123.49. Two, which sets forth the time that establishments licensed to sell alcohol can sell alcohol, and it's contrary to the definition of a licensed premises. So we think those are legal issues that prevent the council from enforcing section 4-2-2B against the field house. Finally, we wanted to note for the record that, you know, other similar establishments do sell alcohol on multiple floors and have not had these issues. We note that Reunion Bar, Double Tap, Summit Bar, and The View are all areas and establishments that sell alcohol on multiple floors and continue to operate today. In response to some comments made by the city attorney, officers who stop by the field house are not there all the time. They stop by infrequently, presumably based on issues with patrons. The staff aren't here to answer questions. My client is here to answer questions about what food may be sold, when it may be sold, when the kitchen is open. Media articles simply describe and rephrase things. They are not direct evidence of what's actually happening. The advertisements in this case speak for themselves. And there's no requirement under the city's code section that the city attorney seeks to enforce today, saying that a percentage of sales is required to show that you are a restaurant. So for those reasons, we think that the city's motion should be denied and that the field house's alcohol license should remain in effect.
Any questions by council?
You had mentioned that the field house serves food until 1:30 in the morning.
Yes, and I do you have questions on details of that?
I'm just saying while they're also serving alcohol till 1:30 in the morning.
That's my understanding. Yes.
Can city staff remind me what time are restaurants supposed to quit serving alcohol according to city ordinance?
Will you please come to the mic?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That depends on the type of establishment. If it's an eating or drinking establishment, really the time is not an issue here. It's really where the alcohol is being served.
Okay.
So the time of the alcohol service really doesn't come into your analysis about where the alcohol is being served. It's a difference about where within one building the licensee can serve alcohol versus, I think that's getting into the drinking establishment 500-foot issue about the timing.
Okay.
And that's where those institutions or establishments can be located in relation to each other.
Okay. Thank you. You had mentioned you had compared, tried to make a comparison between the field house and other bars and restaurants downtown, and you'd mentioned the Reunion Brewery. Have you eaten there?
I have not.
Have you seen their menu?
I have not.
They do a full kitchen. Like, I'm looking at it right now, and I don't want to do, like, a free advertising for anybody, but if you take a look at that and you take a look at what you've given us, I mean, I don't think that's a fair comparison. I just want to throw that out there, that I think that we have people operating downtown that are following the city ordinances just fine. And to say that they're the same and that they get special treatment, I think is not a fair judgment. I just want to throw that out there. Because
was there a question there?
No, I think I asked my question, so thank you.
I have a couple small questions. You've provided as in the exhibits, I think, two or three social media posts regarding the availability of food. If we looked at the entirety of social media posts for the field house, this is what's the proportion of advertising for food versus advertising for alcohol?
I don't have those statistics in front of me today. I could ask my client to. Yeah, we don't have that information here today.
Okay. And you did mention that there's not a threshold for the amount of sales of alcohol versus food, but what are the proportions of sales as far as revenue of alcohol to food?
Well, and that's part of the reason that we requested to delay the hearing is that we just don't have that detailed information with us here today.
Are you asserting that it's more food than alcohol?
I don't have the information necessary to make that assertion today.
Okay.
Are there dates for these posts, the ones that you're showing us?
They may be on there.
It's a little hard to see.
It's not here.
Sorry about that. Yeah, this one's from December 30th, just a couple weeks ago.
When did you start serving food I mean, it opened as serving alcohol. When did you start serving food? If there is...
I'd like to answer that. My name is Tracy Barcolo. I'm one of the owners of the Field House. The food was from day one. And to address the reunion comment, Jim Montanaro is in support of us being open and operating at what we are right now as an eating establishment. I've had discussions with him as of today, and he operates a reunion. And the reunion, the code section, if you look at the code section that they've put in this notice to us, reunion was opened after 1997. So therefore, the reunion would not be exempt under the ordinance that you've notified us on. It would actually not be able to serve alcohol on the first or on the second floor or in the basement like it does now. Double Tap serves in the basement. It's not available on the first floor. The view is obviously rooftop, so you won't even be able to see that. So it would be apples to apples on use and comparison. And Poly Eyes only sells pizza. So we are a comparable restaurant to a Poly Eyes. Not probably the best quality. We're working on it, but we do sell pizza just like Poly Eyes Pizza does.
Is it your principal business to sell pizza?
Yes, it is. And we're working on making it better.
I have a question about food preparation. Lots of Matzah is a frozen pizza from Hy-Vee.
We have food preparation on that. We also have food preparation on the actual hot dogs. I don't do the day-to-day operations down there. I'm just an investor in the business. But we do have full-time staff that cooks, preps relish, preps things for the hot dogs and things like that, as well as things to go on, additional items on top of the matzah. I don't know the entire process right this second, but it's not just frozen pizza.
So when hiring staff to for the Field House, was one of the listed jobs a cook?
Yes, we have people that are cooks, correct. Yep, that are just on shift as cooks.
As cooks. For lots of matzah.
For more than 60%. If you look at the code, too, the requirement for the code is 60% of the time that we have to sell food. We sell it 100% of the time. So if you look at the ordinance itself, it's only required to be sold 60% of the time. Which most places in town stop selling in, at 10 p.m.
Hearing no other questions, thank you. I want to make sure that council don't have any more questions for either the city attorney or the assistant city attorney, or for the permitters, Eric Hartman. Any other questions for either of them at this point? Okay, all right. I'm gonna ask for a motion for approval, please.
So moved, Harmson.
Second, Wyline.
Okay, council discussion.
Mr. Mayor, just a point of clarification. The motion to approve is a motion to approve the resolution that's in your packet.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Can we maybe redo the...
Oh, it's just to make it clear? Yeah. All right. So I'll just restate the motion. So could I get a motion to approve the resolution that is that's in our packet?
Which would be for the 14-day suspension.
For the 14-day suspension, correct.
So moved.
Moved by Harmson.
Second.
Seconded by Burgess. All right.
Okay.
And then council discussion.
The 14-day suspension is for?
The 14-day suspension.
Alcohol, not the food.
Correct.
And the principal business is food.
License. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think what it looks like to me is what our staff, I think, in the memo sent to us, because I looked through a lot of, like, all of this multiple times. I think I would agree with the assessment of the restaurant requirement being, quote unquote, openly flaunted. I think that was put correctly in the memo. Yeah.
I agree too. I guess based on the record that we saw on the package, I find that the violation occurred and the 14-day suspension recommended by the staff as a right by the code and proportionally to the violation. I will be voting yes for this.
In staff's memo, in the multiple documents, there was one of the definition of a restaurant provided in Iowa City Code of Ordinance, and there were 8 subparts to it, and I feel that what was provided to us as evidence and as exhibits demonstrates very clearly the ways in which each piece of what constitutes a restaurant was violated. So I will be voting in support of this resolution.
I just want to state that it is absolutely not credible that the principal business of the Fieldhouse Bar is pizza. And I believe it is a bar, and primarily a bar, and not operating as a restaurant.
I agree with you.
Yeah, you guys have kind of said it, so I agree.
All right, are we ready to take a vote?
Yes.
All right. Roll call, please.
Harmson?
Yes.
Moe?
Yes.
Saleh?
Yes.
Teague?
Yes.
Weiland?
Yes.
Alter?
Yes.
Burgess?
Yes.
Motion passes 7-0. Could I get a motion to accept correspondence?
Mayor, you did that at the front end.
Oh, you
did
that.
I did. Yes. Thank you. All righty.
Good enough.
All right. Well, we are done with that item. We're going to move on to item number 12, which is council appointments. We have 12A, which is a public art advisory committee. There is one vacancy to fill an unexpired term upon appointment through December 31st, 2027. And we have three different applicants for this one.
I'd like to throw Stephanie Brunia. I thought that was a really interesting application with the background in photography and the Bachelor of Fine Arts and the Master of Fine Arts. So kind of, I just thought I was really impressed with the overall application, you know, plus the experience as a visual artist. So that was, I'd like to support them.
Okay. Any others being nominated? All right, I'm seeing some head shakes for Stephanie Brunia.
Yeah.
Could I get a motion to appoint Stephanie Brunia to the Public Art Advisory Committee?
So move. Saleh.
Second. Burgess.
Sorry.
Moved by Saleh, seconded by Burgess. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes 7-0. We're on to item number 13, announcements of vacancies new. And this is 13A. Civil Service Commission, one vacancy to fill a four-year term, April 6, 2026 through March 31st, 2030. Human Rights Commission, one vacancy to fill an unexpired term upon appointment through December 31st, 2026. Library Board of Trustees, one vacancy to fill an unexpired term upon appointment through June 30th, 2031. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. Can I get a motion to accept correspondence?
So moved. Alter.
Second, Saleh.
All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes 7-0. I have to tell you that the 2031 caught me. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. We're moving on to item number 14, announcements of vacancy previous. 14A, Airport Zoning Board of Adjustment. One vacancy to fill a five-year term. Airport Zoning Board of Adjustment, one vacancy to fill a five-year term. Board of Appeals, one vacancy for a licensed electrician to fill a five-year term. Board of Appeals, one vacancy for a HVAC professional to fill an unexpired term. Historic Preservation Commission, one vacancy for a Brown Street representative to fill a three-year term. Historic Preservation Commission, one vacancy for a Jefferson Street representative to fill a three-year term. Historic Preservation Commission, one vacancy for a Woodlawn Avenue representative to fill a three-year term. Vacancies will remain open until filled. Item number 15 is City Council information, and we'll also report on any boards or committees as well. I would just mention that yesterday was Dr. King's Day, and there was a lot of opportunity for celebrating the life of Dr. King as well as commemorating the legacy, as well as a lot of community togetherness, and it really felt good just to be engaged with a lot of folks from various backgrounds, and it was great celebrations all day.
On that, it was really wonderful to be at the Senior Center as well as Mercer, but the Senior Center was able to kick off its Future Afro Fest.
Black Futures Fest, I think.
Thank you. That is going on for the whole month upcoming, and actually I took special note of it because there's going to be an art opening on February 14th there, and it's all three floors are going to have art. I came in from the parking ramp, and so I came in on the third floor, and they had just finished putting up some installations of both watercolors and then mixed media. It was already stupendous. And then when I got down onto the ground floor where there were some activities, they were starting to put in some sculpture and clay work. And this is only the beginning. So it's going to be very exciting on the 14th, not to mention throughout the month where there's going to be a lot of different activities. So it was tremendous. And it was incredibly peaceful and calm and awesome because we got to make a little mural.
Yeah.
Do art.
To paint. Agreed.
So, big props to Latasha Deloche.
Absolutely. Yes. Agreed. All right. We'll move on to item number 16, reports on items from city staff, city manager's office.
Not tonight, thanks.
City attorney's office.
Nothing for me, thank you.
And our city clerk office.
Thank you.
All right. Item number 17, can I get a motion to adjourn, please?
Move.
Second.
Moved by Sala, seconded by Alter. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. We are adjourned. Enjoy the evening.
Yes.